Inspector Pirbright?
It's me, Gov.
Sid, please don't call me Gov.
Is that Joe Tudor, sir? I'm a mafioso.
Have we got him a lawyer yet? A brief, I believe they call them.
That's just it. Didn't want to see a lawyer. He has to see Miss Tea Time.
Did he now? Well, let him see her, if she'll come.
I did, and she came. She's just left, in fact. I sent a car for her. I thought you'd want me to.
Quite right.
I was a bit worried, though. I mean, she's got nothing to do with solicitors, has she?
Which is much to her credit. Don't worry, Sid. She qualifies for the time-honoured and quite legitimate role of prisoner's friend. Come in. I'll tell you what, though, Sid.
Inspector!
Ah, Miss Tea Time's here now.
May I come in now?
Please do. Do sit down. Excuse me a second. Yes, Sid, I was going to say, can you come over here as soon as you're free? I want you to have a word with those business efficiency chaps, or whatever they're called.
Okay, Gov.
And please don't call me... No, never mind.
I do hope that I've done nothing improper in respect of public funds by soliciting another lift in one of your nice police cars. I do love older vehicles. They're so stately and smell of pine forests.
I'm delighted to oblige you in so small a matter, Miss Teatime. I trust you found your friend Mr. Tudor well and that you were able to give him such advice as he required?
Come, Inspector, you must have seen enough of Mr. Tudor by now to realise that he's a very odious gentleman indeed, and vicious.
You conveyed a somewhat different impression the other day.
That was before he saw fit to presume upon mutual acquaintance in order to try and involve me in his squalid activities. If there is one thing I learned from my mother's side of the family, all those dreadful marquises, it is to abhor presumption on acquaintance.
I must admit I was surprised when he asked to see you, Miss Teatime. You must have been most embarrassed.
It was his request that was embarrassing, Mr. Pirbright. He wishes me to intercede on his behalf in order, as I think he expressed it, to prevent your pinning a rap on him. Have I got that right? Pinning a rap. Sounds like some sort of makeshift costume. But I think I'm worldly enough to know that he was probably referring to an impending criminal charge.
A murder charge, in point of fact.
Oh, I feared as much.
He seems to have great faith in you.
I have to tell you, Inspector, and I do so with no pride, that Mr. Tudor has taken a shine to me. He's been pressing his suit with all the subtlety and finesse of Tyrannosaurus Rex for some days now. I have no intention of giving up my very interesting and comfortable life in Flaxborough to become a gangster's mole. And I wish to be free of his attentions before he sees fit to make me an offer I can't refuse.
I think you're wise.
However, he's become more and more revealing to me, embarrassingly so and quite unsolicited. To be quite candid, Mr. Pirbright, and with the greatest reluctance, I have to record my conviction that Mr. Tudor has not killed anybody for some little while.
Do you know why he's here?
I believe I do, Inspector.
And are you going to tell me?
For what it's worth, Inspector. Oh, you don't mind cigars, do you?
They're always a vicarious pleasure to me. Though I don't know whether the late Mr. Hatch's office boasts an ashtray. Ah, no. Ah, well, needs must, I suppose. I hope this tin will do.
Oh, most suitable. Except there seem to be some sweet little pieces of sticky paper in it.
So there are. Odd-looking things. Here, let's tip them out.
Oh, you're most kind. No doubt they fulfil some arcane function which would immediately be clear to people engaged in the running of gambling clubs.
No doubt they do. I wonder what that could be.
It's odd. They seem to stir some long-forgotten childhood memory.
And for me. Still, back to Mr. Tudor.
You will be unable to obtain any confirmation from Mr. Tudor, but my belief is that he came to Flaxborough not to commit a crime, but to prevent one of his minor associates from doing so.
Ah.
He spoke of family troubles, you see. Now, my understanding is that family is a term used very broadly in Mr. Tudor's sense. Probably embraces all those co-religionists of similar occupation, but not necessarily of like eminence.
Did Tudor know the identity of this associate you think he wished to restrain?
Oh, I'm sure he did not. But he was confident that if such a person had arrived here, he would recognize him.
Do you think that Tudor knew that Hatch was the man whose murder was intended? Or Was his attendance at the banquet here last night purely fortuitous? I ask you that because I recall that you provided him with the ticket.
True. I did so at first to get him from under my feet and prevent him from pressing his suit. But I've been wondering ever since if he had precise knowledge of what was going to happen. I'm inclined to doubt it.
Might he not, in fact, have been less concerned to stop a murder than to take over for himself the protection, as he would understand the word, of a profitable, sub-legal enterprise? The argument is purely hypothetical, naturally.
I always try to adopt a balanced view, Mr. Pyrwhite, especially when there exists a personal commitment of the kind, for instance, that a ticket agency implies. However, I do not quarrel with your assessment of Mr. Tudor's capabilities. Hypothetically speaking, if he were to pass wind, it would rain granite chips.
Brought your tea, sir.
Oh, thank you, Constable Pook.
I wanted to... Well, about last night, sir. Me losing that gangster like I did. And then Mr. Hatch. I'm sorry, sir.
Don't worry, lad. We know Tudor didn't kill Hatch. In any case, you were the victim of an expert. I think Mr. Tudor, or Tudy-Doo, has been giving policemen the slip since before you were born. Now, don't stand there shaking like a wet dog. You'll spill my tea in a minute. Just stick it down on the table there.
Oh, right-o, sir. Hey. Oh, sir.
Pardon?
Oh, sir. Oh, yeah.
What on earth is it? What are you looking at? Oh, well, that's the letter Mr. Hatch got from the medical.
Oh, not the letter, sir. Look, the envelope.
Envelope?
Yes, sir. Oh, sir.
Now, don't start old sirring again. There's a good chap. Listen, Pook, I can see you're excited for some reason. If you can see something about that envelope which I can't, and which might help us to...
First day cover, sir.
What?
First day cover. Oh, excuse me, sir. Do you think it'd be...
Listen, Pook, will you please explain what it is that you find so exciting?
That's a first day cover, sir. That means it were posted on first day of new issue. Postmark there, you see, sir, is June the 8th. And that is when this stamp was first on sale, sir. Sir, if it'd be possible, I mean, when this envelope ain't needed no more.
May I ask how you come to know these fascinating things?
Well, philately's me hobby, sir.
You don't say?
Oh, aye. I've been collecting stamps since I were a lad.
I see. And is there anything particularly notable about this stamp, apart from the date of cancellation?
Oh, aye, sir. This is the very first American issue showing a president during his own lifetime. I'm not sure, but I think Mr. Nixon had the rules changed himself. At any rate, it's a very collectible item.
In other words, you want me to purloin this for you when it's not wanted any more as evidence?
Oh, well, that'd be right good of you, sir. The wife would be thrilled to bits.
Your wife?
Oh, aye. Dora's as daft on stamps as me. We get curled up on that sofa with us albums, and there's now to shift us.
Really?
Oh, aye. But she forgot to post letter with us self-addressed envelopes, do you see? What we send to this dealer in New York for him to get stamped for us and put in mail. She were kicking herself.
I see. That's a usual arrangement, is it, for stamp firms to post letters for clients on particular days?
Oh, aye. That's how it's done, you see.
Yes, I think I do. Tell me, these bits of paper, sticky one side, I thought I'd seen the like before. Now I remember. They're called stamp hinges, aren't they?
Oh, that's right, sir. Or mounts. For mounting stamps in your albums.
Sit down a minute, Mr. Pook.
What? Me, sir?
You. I want you to tell me if this means anything to you, this telegram. Two naked nuns available Philadelphia, stop. Perf 1915, stop. 8 days option, stop. $3,005, stop. Instruct London soonest, stop. Informed four nuns on offer Dallas, stop. We'll investigate.
Oh, but, wow, sir, flipping Moses, I mean, well, blew me neck, sir.
I see, that does mean something to you.
Well, they're ever so rare, you know.
Indeed.
Oh, nor half, sir. They reckon there's only 5 in existence, apart from that one in Vatican. And that ain't likely to get into circulation, is it, sir?
I honestly wouldn't know. Look, Pook, it's obvious that you have hidden depths. I'd like you to treat me as an untutored child for a while and explain in simple terms what this is all about. Now, don't be nervous. But I believe you have the key to something extremely important.
Ooh, me, sir?
Yes, you. Now, tell me about it.
Well, sir, you see, sir, it's to do with stamps, you see.
Well, really, Mr. Pervright, of course I know what a transposed vignette is. I once spotted one myself.
I was speaking over the transatlantic telephone at 4 o'clock this afternoon to Captain Michael West of the New York Police.
What? New York, America?
That New York, sir, yes.
I trust you have some very good reason, Mr. Pervright. Authorization for things like that's terribly difficult to obtain, even in advance. Retrospectively, good heavens.
It wasn't a very lengthy call, sir. It was to his station, Precinct House, I think is the New York term, that the letter purporting to prophesy our murder was sent. He'd kept the letter itself on file, of course, but it was mainly the envelope I wanted to talk about.
The envelope?
Fortunately, it hadn't been thrown away. Now, this is our one, which contained the threat to Mr. Hatch. The dimensions of the envelopes checked exactly, postmarks were identical, same district, same time.
Remarkable.
The stamps were of different denominations, as one was going to an address in New York and the other coming here, but they belonged to the same new commemorative issue. Now, sir, perhaps we can consider the letters. The first is a warning to the police, the American police, who reasonably might be expected to pass the warning on, that a mafia-style murder is planned to take place in Flaxborough. No names are offered, only the location. The second letter is very different. It's a threat to a specific person, Mr. Hatch, and it's addressed to that person direct. As I say, the letters seemed utterly different in intention. One, an informer's tip-off. The other, a death sentence. Mm. Each, though, has a ring of authenticity. And because they turn up at different times in the hands of unrelated and widely separated people, each seems to reinforce the credibility of the other. But only so long as the letters remain 3,000 miles apart and are not examined jointly for signs of their having been concocted by the same writer. We were extremely lucky, you know, sir, in turning up such extraordinarily quick workers as those New York people. I put our question of whether there was a firm of stamp dealers in their locality whose name began with O, X and O, and in less than 2 hours, they rang back, having not only traced the firm, but most perceptibly interviewed one of its principals.
Remarkable. Quite remarkable.
Now then, sir. Sergeant Love and I, separately and together, have had a series of conversations with one of the management consultants employed by Mr. Hatch. It took a long time to get the man to speak plain English, but what he told us... I'm afraid we'll have to wait for now, sir.
Here we are, sir.
Ah, come in, Mr. Amis.
I hope I haven't kept you gentlemen. I was taking some tea.
This is Mr. Chubb, the Chief Constable. Mr. Amis, who has been so very helpful.
Yes, we met last night. I do sympathize, Mr. Amis. I realize that Miss Hatch's right hand and... Well, your cool head and assistance are much appreciated.
I would do anything, Chief Constable. Anything at all to assist in... Well... Mr. Hatch.
I'm sure you would. And it does you great credit, Mr. Amis.
I realize you must be very busy, Mr. Amis, so I'll come straight to the point. Or to a point, rather. Some rather odd features have come to light in the records of this club's finances. I must ask you, first of all, if you have any knowledge of them.
If by odd you mean dishonest. No, Inspector. I certainly don't.
Very well. Now, on the 18th of February this year, a cheque was issued in favour of OXO, presumably the beef extract manufacturers. Correct?
If what you have there is a record of the cheque counterfoils, that is your answer, I suppose. I can scarcely be expected to recall from memory one single cheque out of all that go to our suppliers.
The amount is for £775. That would buy rather a lot of beef cubes, wouldn't it, sir?
It would indeed. We shall have to see what is on the invoice. Somebody slipped up, obviously.
It would appear that the club was out of beef cubes again by the 30th of May. The supply that was ordered on that occasion cost £1,120.
I suggest you have a look at the invoice. As you say, there certainly is something odd about this.
No invoice has been found, Mr. Amis, and no receipt. Indeed, during the past 14 months, a total of £4,000 is indicated by these OXO counterfoils, yet not one invoice or receipt appears to exist.
Oh, dear. I'm sorry, Inspector. but I really can't imagine what he'd been doing.
He? Whom do you mean by he?
Poor old Mr. Hatch. Who else? Now look, Inspector. Hatch liked to refer to me as his private secretary. In fact, I was his hired help, that's all. One thing I certainly was not, and that was his company secretary.
But you did handle checks.
As an office boy might be said to handle checks.
It was not uncommon, I understand, sir, for you to take a batch of checks for signature before all the details had been filled in, and for you then to complete them in your own time. Am I right?
That did happen occasionally.
From this point, Mr. Amis, I'm going to ask you questions of a more searching nature. It is your right to have advice as to how to answer them, if indeed you wish to answer them at all.
I shouldn't be altogether flabbergasted if you were to tell me that there had been some tax fiddles here, or even something a bit close to the wind where the gaming and girls were concerned. But don't worry. Hatch was too sharp to give me any hints, let alone make me a partner in crime. Do you know why he gave me this job, Inspector? Simply because he thought it would be rather posh to have a private secretary, just as he put that ridiculous swimming pool in his garden. I feel I have a sort of kinship with that pool. We're both status symbols.
And do you feel kinship with this Olsen and Morgan?
I beg your pardon.
I was referring to Mr. Hatch's somewhat expensive sporting gun.
Yes. It would have been an expensive one, naturally.
You're not a shooting man yourself, sir?
I'm afraid not. You will not find me responding favourably to the dropping of famous names in that department, Inspector.
A more peaceable occupation, perhaps, would appeal to you?
Conceivably.
Let us see, then, if I may drop a name to which you will respond, one with essentially pacific associations.
Gawk.
Gibbons.
The decline and fall, gentlemen, of the Roman Empire.
Should be on Brain of Britain, sir.
Thank you, Sergeant.
That one, I think, you'll find was a Gibbon singular. Gibbons is the name on a famous and exhaustive catalogue of postage stamps.
Ah, yes. Yes, indeed.
We'll try another. How do you react to the resonance of Oxonia Philatelic Trading Corporation of New York and London?
So unlikely a title must be genuine, I suppose. I presume we have arrived at the heavy-hinting stage, have we, Inspector?
No, sir. At the honest explanation stage, I should have hoped. Tell me this for a start. When you handed Hatch an uncompleted cheque made out to Oxo for him to sign in that off-handed and very business-like way that he probably imagined was appropriate to being rich and well-bred, was it not with the clear intention of expanding Oxo to Oxonia, adding the rest of the firm's title and finally inserting the amount, a substantial amount, for payment?
Good Lord.
And did you not pay to the London branch of Oxonia by the method I have described a total of just over £4,000 since February of last year?
Good Lord. Well, good Lord.
For what?
For a number of rare stamps you had commissioned the firm to obtain for you, notably a set of 5 misprints from the 2.5 lira Vatican City issue of 1932.
Dear God. Do I look like a stamp collector?
Possibly not, sir. But one does not have to look like an engraver to draw notes from a bank. A valuable stamp is as good as a load of currency. Better, because it's less likely to depreciate, and it can be more privately negotiated.
2.5 lira doesn't sound much like a load of currency, not even by 1932 standards.
You really must stop trying to sell your intelligence short, Mr. Amis. Is your desk, is it not?
Until you arrived, Inspector, yes.
And here in the drawer, a lens, a pair of tweezers, a strange and rectangular piece of plastic, rather like a ruler, though with serrated edges, and these stamp hinges or mounts. You may claim not to look like a stamp collector, but you seem to have acquired some of the tools of the trade, even a perforation gauge. Remember the specifications of the naked nuns, Mr. Amis? 19 and 15?
A bit young for nuns, surely.
19 perforations on the horizontal sides, 15 on the vertical. And naked nuns, the trade nickname for the result of a rather puckish philatelic mishap in 1932, whereby 2 vignette plates were transposed at the printers. The frame of the stamp depicted a procession of nuns, and the oval insertion, the so-called head plate, should have been a portrait of Pope Pius XI, but what actually appeared was one of Manet's Olympia.
Olympia? A famous nude painting, Sergeant.
French, I believe.
It's obvious that I should have known better than to pretend absolute ignorance, Inspector. I simply didn't want to be drawn into an investigation of Hatch's affairs. I might add that the possibility of my receiving attention from his gangster friends didn't appeal much either.
Ah, yes. His mafia associations. What do you know about those, Mr. Amos?
Virtually nothing. Except that Hatch was having to pay out money. It's true, of course, that I do know a little about stamps. I advised Hatch on which ones he should buy. It is possible that he used some of them to meet his protection bills. I don't know. As you say, though, stamps are negotiable.
I'm glad you've been so frank, sir. This stamps business has been puzzling us a great deal. Hatch was a man of some considerable accomplishment, but I couldn't quite see him as an informed enthusiast in so specialized a field. I suppose, then, that it was you and not Hatch who mailed that packet of letters to New York for Oxonia to give them first-day post under the new presidential commemorative issue.
First I've heard of it.
It was these management consultancy people, wasn't it? You did everything you could to talk Hatch out of it. But as with shotguns, automatic curtains, and yourself, he wanted status symbols. He knew that other businesses, big businesses, multinationals even, were using the services of these people, so he had to have them too. So you have to think quickly for the somewhat drastic measure that their inquisitiveness would force you to take. From an ordinary audit, you had nothing to fear. The books showed no payments that hadn't received Hatch's authority or were outside the normal scope of his business, but an efficiency organization, that was something different. It was bound to bring into question a catering system that required as big an outlay on beef cubes as on whiskey. Edmund Amos, I must warn you that you will shortly be charged with the murder of Arnold Hatch.
Good Lord.
You do not have to say anything, but I must warn you that anything you do say will be taken down and may be used in evidence against you. Do you wish to say anything at this stage, Mr. Amos?
Is that usual?
You must decide for yourself, Mr. Amos. The charge will be made formally at the police station, to which you will be taken now. You may confer with your solicitor as soon as you wish. Every facility will be given you. Sid?
Oh, yeah, right. Come along, Mr. Amos. The car's outside.
Yes. Well, goodbye, Mr. Chubb. Inspector. I expect I'll see you later. Good morning.
I must say, I didn't expect him to cave in. In a sense, I didn't want him to. It somehow makes the affair that much more squalid. If he hadn't, of course, he would have been asked to submit to a simple medical examination. There's almost certainly a deep bruise on his right shoulder. It should still be obvious at remand reception, though. Amos is a townsman, a Londoner, and not in the tweedy weekending set either. A 12-ball would kick him like a cannon.
Oh, that's perfectly true.
Well, I must get over to Fenn Street now, sir. Do you wish to come?
I think not, Mr. Pertwright. Unless there's something that cannot wait till morning.
No, sir.
What about a warrant, by the way? You'll be searching the fellow's flat, I take it.
Tomorrow.
For the stamps?
He may tell us where they are. If not, I doubt if we shall ever find them. 5 small scraps of paper.
Oh, dear.
Oh, the case doesn't depend on them, sir. Oxonia's London manager told me over the phone that Hatch collects his buys in person and always has the cheque ready. The manager says he can identify Hatch whenever we want him to. He described him to me just to prove it.
Hey, miss, I suppose?
Yes, sir.
I wonder how the man consistently kept his employer ignorant of these dealings. There must have been letters sometimes, and there would have been addressed to Hatch.
Yes, here at the club, sir, where Amos was a conscientious early starter whose job it was to open the mail anyway.
Hmm.
Telegrams might have been more tricky. My guess is he told Oxonia to curb their agent's exuberance after he received that wire from Philadelphia that gave Armis Ryland nightmares about abducted nuns and white slaving.
You haven't told me, you know, why you were so confident that an outsider couldn't have shot that poor fellow. The gangster person, for instance. Or even Crispin. Well, I know he's a counsellor, but he gets up to some pretty queer tricks, they tell me.
Hatch's gun was kept in that room, the one next to this office. It would have to be brought out and hidden behind a pile of planks, as it happens, before too many customers or staff were milling about. I can't see how Crispin or Tudor could have managed that. And whoever subsequently rammed the gun barrel through the window and pulled the trigger must have known for an absolute certainty who was inside that washroom. It must have been someone who had been with Hatch up to that moment and actually seen him go in to have a wash.
That does seem very logical, Mr. Pirbright, but what was to prevent a person lurking in the grounds, a scoundrel such as what is named Tudor, and from taking a shot at Hatch as soon as he put a light on?
Frosted glass, sir.
Ah.
This is your train, Mr. Tudor. Constable Pook will travel with you to London, and then one of the Met Constables will see you onto your flight.
Yeah, okay, Cap, cool it, huh? Well, Luce, I guess this is goodbye.
Yes. Goodbye, Mr. Tudor.
Joe. If ever you come stateside, you'll look me up, huh?
If ever I do, but I'm afraid my commitments here make that highly unlikely. Give my love to Uncle McNamara.
Oh, gee, Luce. Parting is such sweet sorrow.
You must get aboard, Mr. Tudor.
Aye, come on, sir.
You give me a minute, Cop, okay? Well, Luce, it was not to be, huh?
I'm afraid not.
Yes, sirrah, sirrah, huh?
I think that sums it up admirably.
Mr. Tudor.
Okay. Listen, if anybody ever puts out a contract on you, think I will not be raising my little finger to stop it, okay?
I stand warned.
Luce, I... Oh, what the hell? So long. You got class, Luce. And great legs.
Rather reminiscent of that last scene in Casablanca, didn't you think? Without the aeroplane, of course.
May I ask a favor, Inspector?
Anything, Miss Teton.
Will you please escort me to the nearest hostelry where a large measure of malt whiskey can be obtained? Even the public bar of the Plate Layer's Arms will suffice.
I shall be delighted.
And I think that on this occasion I shall dispense altogether with the tea.
That was the final part of The Naked Nuns by Colin Watson. And in today's episode, you heard John Rowe, Paul Downing, Anne Rye, Joseph Alessi, Peter Rylands, Jeffrey Banks, Daniel Cole, and David Fleischman. It was dramatised by Christopher Dennis.